This is the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio.
Don't sweat the technique.
On the AYG List, I talk with fascinating people. Some at the top of their game, others still climbing. All possessing an uncommon commitment to owning their stories and achieving their vision. I also navigate sometimes complex conversations that unpack and contextualize current events with thoughtful individuals who represent a diverse array of well-informed and passionately articulated perspectives.
Hang out with April on Facebook, peek into her world on Instagram, and follow her on Twitter at the AYG List. Visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog at theayglist.com. And now, April Yvonne Garrett.
Don't sweat the technique.
Author, satirist, comedian, and public speaker, Baratunde Thurston is the CEO and co-founder of Cultivated Wit, a company that combines technology with humor. Informed by years of honing his craft as the director of digital for the satirical news site The Onion and Jack and Jill Politics, a black political blog, Baratunde weaves his undeniably accessible intellect, insightful wit, and constant need for expression and connection into a vibrant public tapestry that explores complex social issues with a lighter hand but profound touch. Author of four books, including his New York Times bestseller, How to Be Black, Baratunde ranks among the most sought-after voices of his generation globally regarding our digital future in storytelling, satire in democracy, and race and politics. Today, we talk influences, creating systems of support, finding incubators for your brilliance, and how he came into the world born full and ready to go. Baratunde, thank you so much for being with me today on the AYG List.
Thank you for having me. It's a nice family reunion.
Amen. All right. So you are a Renaissance man, and according to many of my friends and acquaintances, one of the most interesting people they are at a loss for words to codify.
Oh, wow. Good.
Yeah. You are also the number one man several of my female friends are angry I'm not married to. Yeah. I just learned that, you know, kind of this weekish. And
okay.
I was like, oh, okay. Seriously, I think that's more of a way for them to prod me about you and far less generous about my personal predicament. But all of this leads me to my first question, which is, what would be the best way for a woman you were dating to describe who you are and what you do to her parents?
And, oh, got it. Okay. Wow. That's different. Well done.
Yeah.
All right. She would say that I give amazing massages, that I am very sweet and hilarious, and that I'm smart. She would say I'm very smart. In terms of her parents and putting them at ease, if they are the sort of parents that need to be put at ease about the man spending time with their daughter, she would say he's an author. He wrote this really ridiculous and oddly popular book called How to Be Black that children are being forced to read in schools across the country. So they would hopefully see some sustainability in that.
Yeah.
And that he's a public speaker, that he's a tech nerd and advises companies and organizations, and that he has been to the White House not as a tourist, and that should assuage any fears they have that I am not a legitimate person.
Yeah. That's good.
The massages.
Yeah, I would think, well, for her, that would be important. I mean,
that would be for her very important. Parents probably don't really want to know that.
Right. For any woman, that is important. Okay, note to self. All right, anyway, my next question is about what makes you who you are, like your past and your present. Let's imagine you are a crock pot.
Okay.
From the day of your conception to the date of your birth, which we both share, by the way, 9/11 babies represent.
Mm-hmm.
Up to this moment, a bunch of ingredients have been added to the pot to make you the interesting, tasty dish you are right now. So, what are your base ingredients that can always be tasted, your major sources of protein, some flavors that are in the mix but go overpowered by newer, more dominant spices, and what are some of the flavors we can detect but we can't quite identify?
That last one's definitely watermelon. kind of seriously, is watermelon. My base ingredient is my mother, and she ate a lot of watermelon when I was when she was pregnant with me, like a lot. Like she was kind of addicted to it. And she tells this story, which I haven't been able to verify. We didn't have iPhones and even handheld camcorders at the time. But right. Apparently I came out ready to go. I just had to go to the bathroom, and I just peed
what?
All over the doctors. I just emerged
Stop
and
it.
Was like, what's up, y'all? Boom. So, yeah, I was sort of born full. And
did she blame that on the watermelon consumption? Or?
Yeah, she did. She did. She's like, it must have been all that watermelon. Yeah,
because my mom was, it was cantaloupe. So,
see, there you go. There you go. So yeah. there's some similarity there.
No,
you asked, there was like four different layers.
Of course there are four
question.
Different layers because I'm April. But the base ingredient is your mom. And
and I think in terms of those ingredients, there's a mix of sort of performance need, sort of communication. Like I just got to be talking or writing or dancing. The expression is a major ingredient, and in the format almost doesn't matter. I've played instruments, I've done musicals, I talk a lot, writing things down, tweeting hard. There's just a lot of thoughts that need different exits from my my mind and my body, and that's always been the case.
So all the world is a stage.
Yeah, yeah, every single
one. For me, all the world is a runway. Yeah. All the world is a catwalk.
Yeah.
And so all the world is a stage for you. Okay, got that. All right, good.
Yep.
And so the major sources of protein, institutions, individuals, life experiences that kind of shaped kind of like the core outside of your mom and your family.
Yeah, D.C., you know, growing up in Columbia Heights in the 80s. You know, we had our own Rob Ford before there was a Rob Ford. You know, this dude is like replaying some old news now. So we've already had the crackhead mayor. Why are you so late? Or I guess you're bringing it back. I mean, retro is kind of in, so maybe it's like bell bottoms and crackhead mayors are all have on a cycle.
Right.
And so yeah, definitely this being born in that city, a very political city, a very black city at the time, a bit of a divided city, and one that was undergoing some decline when I was there, but also a walkable city, a heavy public transit city, a city with a lot of culture. You know, I did youth orchestra stuff. I did Boy Scouts. You're close enough to the beach that you could still drive to it. You could still drive to the mountains, and we would go camping on these really affordable family vacations. And there's just something pretty unique. And obviously, of the nation's capital, where all these people swing through, and it's very political, and the local news is national news. That was a huge catalyst for me. I think there was a big spark in being in that environment versus some other town. I'm sure I would still be a lot of who I am, but I'd be different.
And then some of the flavors that we can detect but we can't quite identify.
So there's I didn't go directly into like being a lawyer or a judge or even elected politics, but there's a little seasoning of intolerance for injustice that finds its way into a lot of the stuff that I do without it necessarily being the core of what I do, because it's not the day job, isn't, you know, leading rallies. But through the expression, that's a constant theme. And I remember we did a lot of work when I was young. There's a soup kitchen called Martha's Table, and my mother used to take me there all the time, like when I was in grade school. Like after school was just a regular occurrence to go there and ride around in the wagon called McKenna's Wagon and distribute food. And I remember being really upset. I was like, why do these people not have homes, or why do they not have a job, or why do they not have a job because they can't get a home, and vice versa. And it just felt very, very wrong. And I still, even in the tiniest things, like it doesn't always have to be political, though I think everything kind of is. It could be just AT&T. You know, I'm like, this is unjust, this wireless bill. This is not what the forefathers and foremothers, like, sacrificed themselves for. This is not what we survived the Middle Passage. You know, this is unjust. So there is, again, that seasoning applies to, that's my old bae. It just goes on everything.
Ah, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I got that. Okay, I'm going to move on to you right now. I'm going to come back to your seasoning of you standing for justice. But I want to go to your writing. You are well known, of course, for your New York Times bestseller, How to Be Black, but I'll get there in a moment, because right now I want to know about your three self-published titles, Better Than Crime, Poking Fun at Politics, the Press, and Pop Culture.
Right.
Keep Mary Falwell away from my Oreo cookies. and right. congressional pages for being so damn sexy. What did these books allow you to express, and what opportunities did they create for you to connect with other people?
So the first one, Better Than Crying, that was the most legit looking and selling of my pre-publisher book experience. That book was my first compilation of things I thought were good enough to charge money for. And it came out in 2004. I had been really dying to, actually, someone we both know, Maui Asgadam, who's a classmate of mine from Harvard.
Yeah.
He had written a book. He gave the speech, one of the speeches at our commencement. And it was a very motivational story. This kid's born in Ethiopia, Eritrea. Mm-hmm. He walks 1,000 miles to a refugee camp in Sudan. His family finally makes it to the States. His older brother and his father are killed in separate drunk driving accidents a few years apart. Mm-hmm. And he makes it known. He gets to Harvard and he's got the full scholarship. And he's just a good, good dude. So he gave this talk and he wrote this book. And he hooked up my mom and me, actually, mostly my mom, and got us passes to see Oprah Winfrey live in Chicago. And we crashed with him. We crashed with Maui in his bachelor pad where he had, like, one steak and a beer in his refrigerator. We go and, you know, any woman is in love with Oprah, any black woman especially is in love with Oprah. That is, like, a sister from a different family. So we go. But on this trip, Maui also, we're in the taxi cab talking a lot, and he says, "You got to write a book." And he remembered my newsletter that I used to run as an undergrad called Newsflash, which is a satirical comedic news distribution thing, kind of like my personal version of The Onion. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "You just are good at mocking the world. You should bind that all up and do a book." So I proceeded to study the industry and see if anybody cared about me, which they didn't at the time. They're like, "Nope, you're on your own, kid. You're not famous. We don't need you." And I was like, "Fine, I don't need you either. I'll do it myself." Because I don't stop most of the time. That first book was a proof of concept that I had enough words that could fit between covers. I didn't really make money, but I kind of paid for it. So I wasn't in the hole, which is a pretty big deal, and apparently it doesn't happen quite often. And I was proud. It gave me something to hand out. You know, I was doing stand-up at the time, and most stand-up comedians, the first media you create is an album. You know, you create a CD. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something different because I didn't think my stand-up was strong enough to support 45 minutes of audio that would just be hilarious straight through. But I've been writing much longer. So I was like, oh, and no, comedians don't really have books unless they're famous and writing their memoirs. Like Chris Rock has a book, but he's already Chris Rock. Like that.
Yeah.
So this was like sort of an unknown dude, and I wanted something to sell at the back of the room. So it gave me a business card that didn't look like anybody else's business card. It gave me a level of credibility that most other people in my field hadn't sought. You know, it was very rare to hear about a young comic with a book. And they got me on TV, and I got a review in the Boston Globe, and I got to be a part of, I don't think about this very often, but there's a guy named Jimmy Tingle who ran a theater in Davis Square in Somerville, great comic, political satirist. And he did an author series one year every week. There was a different author. The first author was Howard Zinn. I'm like, oh, wow, that's dope. The second author was Cornel West. I was like, what? Look at that. That's great. The third author was me. And
I love it.
I was like, what? you know I'm the publisher, right?
right.
So it was great. And then that put me on the map. The second two, the Keep Jerry Falwell Away from Oreo Cookies and the Thank You Congressional Pages, those were even lighter. You know, like that first book had a barcode. I was sold in a few bookstores. This was straight up I printed myself or just PDF distributed it. And they were – I would write a lot of topical humor at the time in my newsletter and for stage, and I didn't like the fact that they would evaporate. And this was well before Twitter. But I wanted a way to capture these momentary jokes. So I called them Mojo Quarterly, and it was my way of kind of looking back over everything I had written, taking the best of – adding some images, and just, again, always keeping something fresh and kind of current in people's minds. Like, oh, this dude is always producing. Great.
Yeah.
So they did nothing financially, but they were for my own creative side. They kept me moving because I got to have another. If I don't have enough material to fill another quarterly thing, then I'm kind of falling behind.
Yeah.
And they trained people around me, like eventual fans, public, to know that this is a writer. This is a guy who puts things down on paper and not just into the microphone. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the midst of all of that, you connected and co-founded Jack and Jill Politics, a black political blog. And
yeah.
In 2007 to 2012, you served in various capacities and ultimately as the digital director of the satirical news outlet, The Onion. And in 2009, you had your own show on the Science Channel, Popular Science's Future Of. It just seems to me that all of these places were great incubators, very public and profound incubators for you to develop your unique voice. How did each of these contribute to shaping how you communicated with others, but also building this brand? Because a part of what you talked about with regard to your self-published works was allowing an audience to understand that you were a comedian, but you were also a deep thinker. You were also someone who writes. You are also someone who could codify thoughts in a certain way that was kind of non-traditional for someone in your field of endeavor. So talk a little bit about how this allowed you to communicate with others in a more profound way.
Yeah, you're seeing them in exactly the right way, which is as these incubators, these labs, and mm-hmm. each provided a different set of experiments and tests and context. So the, you know, Jack and Jill Politics was one of the first, and that emerged pretty directly from my own personal blogging mm-hmm. and from Mojo Quarterly stuff. Like, I was writing these topical political jokes, and I was paired up with Cheryl Conti. We were introduced by a mutual friend in Chicago and at a convention called Yearly Coast. Now it's called Netroots Nation, but it was the popular progressive blog Daily Coast organized a bunch of people who had never really met in person, like people who comment on the internet about politics, to come physically together and try to organize more politically and be a, more of a force, and not just scattered people angry at George W. Bush. So we formed up and saw an opening around black people's voices politically online, which weren't very populous at the time. There was blogging was still kind of new in general, but it had definitely taken off in the tech world. It started to take off in fashion and hip-hop, but in terms of politics and black people, there was a wide opening. So we're like, all right, let's do it. And so what I got out of it was a little bit of teamwork, because I was working with Cheryl closely, and I had been so solo. Stand-up is a solo art. My personal blog was solo. The Mojo, it was all just like, here's what I think. Here's how I think the design should look. And with some help of my girlfriend at the time, it was, you know, still basically me and my show. With Cheryl, we had to share, and that was cool. And we started recruiting people. It gave me a daily platform, and sometimes an hourly platform, depending on what was going on in the news.
Right.
And I had a full-time job, you know, as a consultant doing telecom and media. So I would have to move fast. I would learn to write very, very fast. During my lunch break, I would fire off, you know, a 1,500-word screed about the Congressional Black Caucus or about some latest thing in Iraq or whatever the topic was. So it was speed. It was finding the relevance in almost any news item for our audience. And it taught me, I was like a quick reaction force in my own mind, at least, of like, somebody did something stupid. You got to call it out.
Right.
So much of the editorial content there was just, you know, it was an angry time. It was just like, that's the president? Really? Ah.
Yeah.
And then that anger shifted in 2007 to 2008 with the Obama campaign. Mm-hmm. We all on the left side started to see a way out. We're like, all right, we have like 30 candidates. One of them's got to be able to take on this Republican Party. We're not sure who it is. John Edwards? That seemed like an amazing possibility at the time. Remember that?
Didn't it? So true.
Hillary Clinton, who had been training for this her whole life. You know, Bill, like there were so many people. And then this dude, Barack Obama. And so it was through Jack and Jill Politics with all this practice writing that I found Obama. I started writing about him really early on after seeing him at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Mm-hmm. And that helped. You know, what Jack and Jill Politics gave me as well was credibility as a voice. If you have a regular outlet to say stuff and proof that people are listening, you're a voice credible. And it doesn't matter what channel that's on. You know, the internet is this big channel, and you can tune it kind of however you want. So to other people, I was a leader, and that wasn't the goal. Like, the goal was just to get some stuff off our chests.
Yeah.
And leadership was a byproduct after being able to voice the feelings that other people were having, and they sometimes felt alone. So being able to call out the media coverage for how they were treating Obama, older black leadership for how they were initially treating Obama, like, you're not one of us, you don't have slave blood, like all that whackness. So
Right.
That blog directly led to me being on NPR was on Farai Chidea's show, News and Note, regularly, and it directly led to me being on CNN for the first time with Reverend Jesse Jackson. My first appearance on CNN was with Jesse Jackson. And so clearly those opened doors. The the Science Channel show, that was about a different medium. That's TV. I'd never done television other than talking into a box about what I thought. You know, I have opinions. I'm a pundit. And that's a slippery slope. You know, because you can eventually land in just a big pile of BS, loving the sound of your own voice and the accolades of people who are also media people. So the Science Channel show, I got to be out in the field. I got to travel. I got to go to Japan for the first time in my life. And really, it was all about the future and what our life would be there. It really didn't have anything to do with race and distantly to do with politics. It was about society to me and about how we could possibly reorganize ourselves, how the fun gadgets we'll have. And it was cool, very cool, to be a black dude hosting that show.
Absolutely.
And I would run into kids in Brooklyn, in Bed-Stuy, and they would recognize me from the Science Channel. And I'm like, yo, there's something going on here with these little black kids. I'm like, you're that brother from the Science Channel. And it just gave them so much excitement, which gave me excitement. We were mutually excited. We were doing circular high fives. But I also learned, working in camera, working in the field, there was no set. Yeah. Every shoot was different. That was fun. And then the last thing you mentioned was
The Onion.
The Onion. That was the biggest splash. You know, that was in some ways me coming home. I had been doing The Onion before I even knew it existed back in 1996 when I started my email newsletter. I had still, even with Jack and Jill Politics, been working heavily solo. I didn't have an editor, you know, at Jack and Jill Politics. It wasn't a committee of people deciding what articles got written and what headlines were funny. And nobody was telling me what was funny. You know, I was in charge of that. I felt it or I didn't. And now I'm going into a place that's been funny far longer than I have been engaged in the sport. I was like 20 years old. And I have a team to tell me what to do, to work with, and that I have to tell what to do. We're dealing with advertisers, which I never really had to deal with that before. I mean, a little blog ads thing, but major sponsors and events and dealing with, you know, these sort of, I've cultivated this solo personality and voice, but now I'm joining a voice much bigger than my own that is different from mine. As much as I love and respect The Onion, that's not quite my voice. And so I had to learn to do a different kind of code switch, actually. I'm like, okay, I'm an Onion voice. And speaking publicly, am I speaking as me? Am I speaking as The Onion? And so those voices did get closer together. They couldn't help it after so much time. But I learned a lot about quality there, about deliberation, about why you pursue one joke over another. And there's just so much more thought went into it than I ever imagined. Sometimes too much thought. Sometimes things move a little too slowly. Yeah. And then I got there, the first job I ever had where I could do everything I loved in one paycheck. It wasn't a big paycheck. It wasn't necessarily enough. But I could be funny, I could be technological, I could be political, all in one. I mean, I joined as politics editor. My job was to wrangle and coordinate the 2008 election coverage, which we called War for the White House. And so I got to read all the blogs I would read and watch all the news I would read, but I had a different kind of outlet. And so the things that were always just going to stand up a bit in Jack and Jill Politics, now it's like I had to think with onion brain, okay, well, how do we make this even more absurd? Can you make this even more absurd? Like, how do you make Sarah Palin more absurd? And so it was so much fun. And and I learned what it was like to be a part of a big comedy organization, which there's so few. You know, there are a lot of big legal organizations, sports organizations, but you got like The Daily Show, Colbert, The Onion, maybe Saturday Night Live, Funny or Die. It's a handful of major comedic outlets that people actually recognize. And a lot of them are single shows. It's like, oh, it's How I Met Your Mother for a few seasons before people kind of move their tastes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tons. Oh, my God. So much. It was basically grad school. The Onion was grad school.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So there is a story behind the way How to Be Black came about. Will you share that story and also speak about your masterful staging of its rollout?
Sure. There are stories within stories about how that book came about. And given what we've discussed, you'll get the more complete connection of dots. So the book really started at Jack and Jill Politics. And we had gotten so much love and credibility in, you know, between 2007 and 2009 for essentially chronicling the Obama campaign in a way that most media weren't, because they were not sensitive to the racial politics and the dog whistle that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But black folks were like, I'm not crazy. I knew it. I knew Bill Clinton was acting the fool. I knew it. Never trusted him. And there was a lot of animosity out there, and we kind of put words to it. So we were approached by a publishing unit within HarperCollins to do an election guide, to do a book, the two of us, Cheryl and I. And we said, no, we don't want to do an election guide, but we want to do something, some kind of updated black political thought catalog. And we're floating the idea of two titles, the Negropedia, which was based on the punchline of a joke I'd been telling around the time. Turns out there actually is another book called The Negropedia, written by another black writer. The Assimilated Negro is his tagline. He writes for Gawker. Funny. He's a good dude. And then with the New Field Guide to Negroes is what we settled on.
Oh, wow.
So it was a bit of history. It was a bit of, like, explicit political thought, a bit of wit, not overtly like a comedy book, but there would be humor in it.
Sure.
And we got to terms. Advance is going to look like this. Here's a marketing plan, sample chapters, blah, 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 blah. Got our agent to just kind of come in and certify, and the publisher disappeared.
Ooh.
And when I say disappeared, like, just no response, no phone calls, no emails. We were sending certified letters.
Oh, wow.
We're like, what's going on here? And eventually it turns, I mean, this was financial crisis. Publishers were in a extreme crisis, 2008. And we just let it go. You know, we finally understood that a division had folded, and we just, no one had communicated that to us. Oops.
Mm.
So
yeah.
After the election, we were worn out. Emotionally, and then there wasn't much of a break yet. Inauguration, you had the Tea Party emerge instantly, with all these death panel fears and quote unquote town halls, and things got real ugly. I was going through a divorce. This is all summer of 2009. Cheryl was starting a business, so we're like, all right, let's let that go. That book is not going to happen. In the meantime, I was still being me, still being funny, still being black, and being on Twitter heavily, and was playing hashtag games, and there's a lot of fun with politics and sort of a mix of the dozens and snaps and internet culture and text messaging. That's what Twitter heavily was. And so I gave a talk late in the summer of 2009 at a Web 2.0 conference called There's a Hashtag for That, where I just sort of saw the world through hashtags and showed all the fun that could be had, the activism that could be accomplished, et cetera. And one of the stories within that talk was a game I was playing with Elon James White, who runs This Week in Blackness, a daily radio show and occasional video series. And we were talking about how black are you as a one-upsmanship game. So I would say, you know, I bought some wine because it was called Negro Amaro. I'm pro-Negro. How black are you? And he'd say, well, I never really liked Thundercats because Panthro was Lion-O's driver and was always shirtless. And I'd be like, well, I judge kids who watch The Simpsons over The Cosby Show. And he'd say some other thing. So that pulled in a ton of other people because Twitter is this basically very public stoop. And anybody can tap in, whether they're invited explicitly or not.
Right.
I'm talking about this. The crowd's loving it. And one of the, I don't know, 1,500 people in the crowd worked for HarperCollins. And she's like, we need to meet. I went and had that meeting with my manager at the time and three people from Harper, and they said, how about a book? And I was like, oh, well, I got this concept for a book, this, like, political theory, sort of witty kind of thing. And they're like, nah, what else you got? Well, how about something with social media? You know, I'm Mr. Twitter, kind of, and Foursquare. And they're like, nah, we got enough social media books. What else you got? And one of them, this guy Bob Miller, white dude, I'd say, in his 50 years of age, wanted somebody to suggest, what about How Black Are You? And they're remembering my talk. And I was like, I don't want to write a book called How Black Are You? That is, people wouldn't get it, or they'd get the wrong thing. White people would abuse it. You know, it just, it seemed dangerous. So Bob Miller, the 50-something-year-old white dude guy, says, what about How to Be Black? And I was like, yes, that is obviously the title of the book. Thank you, guy who shouldn't have even known to think that. That's my job. And so it was great because it was so bold, it was brazen, it was absurd, and it's unaccomplishable. There's no such thing. And so that forced it into the comedy satire realm, but still be able to say serious stuff. that's how the book was born. It was born in sort of three phases. It was born initially as this Jack and Jill politics possible book with Cheryl, then in a sort of this talk at Web 2.0, and then in a meeting in someone's office at HarperCollins. And then the book really was born when I wrote it, and then it changed pretty significantly from that first pitch, but that's the origin story.
And so it came out, and this rollout, I mean, I knew the book was coming out because, you know, we're family, so I knew what was coming, but that campaign was, I have no other word except for masterful. So tell me how you came up with, I'm sure you worked with other people, you are perfectly brilliant, but it was just so good. So talk to me a little bit about, okay, I have this book called How to Be Black, and how do I put this out to the public without people going, excuse me, what are you doing?
So I had a lot of training before this book came out. I had my own stand-up and that personal kind of career. I had the experience of my ex, who was a musician and released several albums, and I'd helped with some of those in some minor and some major ways, depending. I had all this grad school study at The Onion about essentially launching digital products every day, every story is a product launch, but also Onion released books, launched TV shows, and I was a big part and really led the digital marketing for the TV shows that we did with Comedy Central and with IFC at the same time. And the blog, you know, I had a good community. I knew the voice. I knew what this book was, and I knew who I was. And it was very important. I think even before you get into, like, marketing plans, you know, a book really is a mirror for the author, I found. And it's hard to write a full book if you don't know who you are. A personal book, probably even fiction too, honestly, because you have to have a point of view that's pretty clear. And so I knew who I was. I knew where I came from in terms of my family and the schooling and a lot of contradictions in my upbringing, a lot of like single parenthood and some crack nonsense in the streets outside my window, but Sidwell friends and Harvard University. And I reconciled all that. I'm good with all that. There's no angst about who I am and what type of person I am. So that was the most important thing, I think, is just having that sense of self and confidence and then sort of brazenness. Be like, yeah, I got like 60,000 words I want you to read. You know, that's not normal. And it's more than blogging. And it's more than tweeting. So that was the first part. And then orchestrating it was a matter of a lot of common sense and some risks and a lot of teamwork. The common sense was, this is a book called How to Be Black. We're definitely releasing it during Black History Month. It would be stupid not to do that. Why would I do it in any other month when there's a predetermined month for this? So ride the wave. Don't go against the ocean. You will lose every time. Then it was a matter of, I'm a digital person doing this analog thing. How does that work? I got to add more digital. And a lot of it was just natural to do, but I did think about it explicitly, you know, putting hashtags on every other page where the normal version of the title sits in most books. So it's hashtag how to be black instead of how space to be black. You know, doing a bunch of, you know, involving other voices was actually part of the plan. It's like, I want to get other people in this book. It's too big of a topic for one man to talk about. Got to get some women in here. Got to get some regional diversity. And hoping that those people would also be proud of their inclusion and tell their people about it. And we got to have you come out Bell in there, maybe he'll mention it. You know, we
got
Cheryl in there, maybe she'll talk about it on Jack and Jill Politics and not just me. So that was a part of it. But then it was also this, like, embrace the absurdity of it, that how to be black is a ridiculous thing. And, you know, the tagline, if you don't buy this, you're a racist, was on purpose and ridiculous. I know people are going to judge it by its cover. Like, we say don't judge a book by its cover, but sometimes, that's your first impression. So obviously some judgment is going to be based on the cover. How do I disarm that person and their judgment immediately? Jokes! And so this is a comedy book. It's in the humor section. It's got a ridiculous tagline. It's got ridiculous questions inside. And that helps it spread. You know, even in the countdown to the actual kickoff of the book, I just reread it and found everything tweetable from the book and sort of did a timed release tweeting these zingers out of the book. Most of them funny, some of them just poignant, but all of them kind of catchy. And I just never stopped talking about it, ever, ever, ever. I'm on podcasts, I'm occasionally on NPR already, call in, all that. And so Harper and I split the world. And I said, look, I got the digital stuff, just let me do my thing. I hired someone to work with me full time for pretty much a year, you know, prior to the release of this, and brought him on to in August, September of 2011, he came on, and I kind of released him from duty June, July 2012, post-launch.
Wow.
But his job was to help me realize all the ideas. I had 1,000 ideas. I couldn't do them all. I couldn't build everything technically.
Sure.
To get to the real differentiator, I think two things I did stood out. One, I convened a summit with the help of a friend. Her name's Priya Parker, and she runs a business called Thrive Labs that helps you kind of get in touch with who you are, your purpose, articulate and act on it, orient your life to achieving your purpose. There's a mix of life planning and strategy consulting and coaching and yoga all rolled into her custom thing. And we did a session and then convened a council meeting, about 6-7 hours, people very close to me, 7 people plus me, and we called it How to Hack a Bestseller. And I sort of pitched my preliminary plan, told people, like, what is this book really about? Who am I? Like, read some samples, get them a feel for it, and then we all did collective brainstorming around what can you do. The book's written, so it can't really be about the content anymore, but what can you do about the messaging to make this pop? And that brain trust was priceless. You can't really, you can read a lot of marketing books and publicity books, but getting that in, not only did they give ideas, but they made commitments. A lot of help things worth more than money with introductions. And then the other thing I did that stood out among all the marketing, make a list of everyone you know.
Yeah.
Everyone. I went through all my Gmail contacts, exported that, put them in a spreadsheet, organized everybody, unduplicated, deleted, and then categorized. And I'm like, why would this person be, like, what world of mine are they a part of?
Yeah.
What sort of hook is there for them into this title? And what weight do I think they have? And so it's like, are you a comedy person? Are you a Harvard person? Are you somebody that just owes me? Like, have I just been really good to you, and now I'm going to call that in? Because sometimes you just want to be explicit about it. And and this is advice from a guy named Gary Vaynerchuk. I looked at what Seth Godin did, Tim Ferriss, like all these people who are just killing it. And why reinvent the wheel when people have designed some pretty good wheels? And I'm basically trying to have similar motion. So that was about letting people know, hey, I got this book. Here are like 3 things you can do to help and make it easy for people to help you. A lot of folks put something out in the world and then get mad when the world doesn't react in the way that they want. I didn't want to assume anyone knew I was doing this. So always be closing. Always be talking. Because people are busy. People got kids. People got relationships. Yeah. People have debt. You know, there's all sorts of things going on. And it would be really arrogant and foolish for me to just think, oh, everybody who I went to college with obviously knows I have a book coming out. We'll obviously buy it in the timing that's most advantageous to me. No, don't take anything for granted. Yeah. And hit people over the head kindly, but hit them over the head with a Nerf, you know, all that. So all that added up. And luck, you know, I mean, I can't discount that. Harper did their job. They got me on media. They got me on Terry Gross. That changed everything.
Yeah.
And when you're on Terry Gross on the day the book comes out, that's a rare, rare win. And then I delivered, too. Like, I was on there, and it was good. And so I didn't ruin the opportunity I'd been given.
Yeah.
But she's
you're
such a tastemaker. And then that gave, when you're on her, no one else will not have you. Pretty much. The Daily Show didn't have me. I do remember that. They're like, we don't have comedians. But I was fine without that. Yeah.
Right.
What are some of the most interesting responses you've had to How to Be Black?
The visual response, there's connections from people who I wouldn't expect, and there's a different international response. So on the visuals, the cover is a very simple Arial black font, How to Be Black. You can see it across a room, and that was the point. In the hardcover, half are black text on white background, half of the reverse. And that was also to communicate there's no one way to be black, even in a book called How to Be Black. I wanted that kind of visual metaphor. So what's happened that I underestimated significantly was Instagram. People love the visual of people holding the book. It doesn't matter who's holding it. Black person, non-black person, animal, Darth Vader, you know, like people have staged some really hilarious photo shoots with this book. And that's all kind of advertising. It's all a little comedy. And it's weird. It's very, very weird. So that has been a super interesting reaction. The people internationally, like the book is very U.S. I'm American. I was born and raised here. My mama was born and raised here. Her mama before her was born and raised here.
Right.
So not everything from the book Scales Outward. I think it's a window into the U.S. at a certain time with some projection into the future.
Yeah.
Brazil is totally different. You know, the U.K. is a bit different. And so as I've traveled overseas and talked to people about it, mostly there's a fascination because, like, oh, America's really, you guys are really jacked up. You okay?
Right.
You know, what's going on over there? And they have their own flavor of race thing that,
sure.
that they don't always want to contend with overseas. I mean, Holland is a great example. You know, the Netherlands, big role in the slave trade. They just don't acknowledge that.
Mm-hmm.
The Royal Dutch, you know, Shipping Corporation, what were they shipping? Humans.
Right.
But they're still in a bit of denial about that, and they have a big Surinamese population that is not fully integrated into society. And then, you know, the most gratifying reaction has been from people who don't look anything like me. It's been from women from Colombia. I ran into a woman on a flight, and I had this great scene happen. It could only happen in that week that the book came out. I was on a flight to L.A. for fancy Hollywood-type meetings that I didn't ask for, but people were excited about the book. They're like, hey, we want to come and fill your butt with smoke. Would you enjoy that? And I'm like, I love smoke in my butt. Let's do it, Hollywood. And so I'm sitting on the plane. It's like 6:30 in the morning. I have my How to Be Black hoodie, which I always rocked at the time.
Yeah.
And this woman comes up to me, and she's like, everybody in our office is talking about your book. I said, we're meeting next week. And I'm kind of groggy. I have my headphones on. I'm like, why are you talking to me when I clearly don't want to be communicated at? But I'm like, oh, so where do you work? She's like, NBC. And the whole section of the plane is like, what? Who is this dude? What's going on? So, indeed, I had a meeting with some people at NBC. It was flattering as hell. And the woman next to me was like, who are you and what is she talking about? So I handed her a copy of the book, and she read it while I slept. And when I woke up as we were doing our approach, she's like, this is great. This book was my life. This is a very fair-looking Colombiana who has dealt with all kinds of questions of her authentic Latina-ness from the outside world, who like, you're not really Latina. You don't look it. You don't have an accent. You don't do this. You don't eat that. And to be sort of boxed out of your own people by your own people and worth by people who aren't, you know, by white people, be like, oh, you're not really Latina. Come on. There was such an identification with a lot of the themes of the book for her. There's a bunch of other stories like that that are the best. Because I expect black kids who grew up in the city and went to private school and are kind of professional, this is their story. So you're just like holding up their life to them. But for someone born not here dealing with American race weirdness, that's a woman and pale, like that was dope. That was dope.
Yeah. You are now the CEO and co-founder of Cultivated Wit, which merged humor and technology. How was starting this LLC a natural progression in your body of work to this date?
Well, it's it was kind of going the next step with expression. Hell, where we started. One of the things I got most out of the combination of The Onion and my own side hijinks, whether it's the Web 2.0 talk and hashtagging or gaming Foursquare in weird ways, is that our worlds are collapsing because of technology. What is media? What is an app? What is a product? What is a service? You know, who's a customer and who's a producer? Who's on stage and who's in the audience?
Yes.
That's all very porous and malleable and sort of omnidirectional now. And so when it comes to expression and telling stories, the idea of sort of pre-packaging the story in a tight little beginning, middle, end format and then shipping it in a package of bits across the internet as a video file or as an article or as a JPEG is not interesting enough. It's going to run out of legs. And that world, that version of media, that sort of package, the produce, package, ship at people is fading.
Yeah.
We have a different construct for our whole society because of programming and because of the connectivity we have to each other, where there is everything is kind of everything. Everybody's doing everybody's business. I mean, it started with the phone companies getting into cable and the cable companies getting into phones. And now HBO is running apps and Netflix is kind of HBO. And a random person with a cell phone is breaking news in Egypt.
Yeah.
So everything is everything. And in the context of humor and creativity and telling stories, I wanted to keep walking down that path because I see the obsolescence of the sort of broadcast, create, pack, ship model. So Cultivated Wit is a big part of getting to that higher place in storytelling. We can have programmers and designers and writers and creative people all work together to do something neither of them could do on their own. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do with our comedy hackathons. We put on live events where these teams come up with ideas and sort of improvise and build something and pitch it to the public. And it's a weird, hilarious, new type of comedy show. No one's done that
before. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Part of it is looking at the opportunity. When you think about even in the marketing advertising world and the political world, they're very similar when it comes to messages. You used to have a world where some principal, the CEO or the marketing council or the president mm-hmm. or the people around that person, here's our policy, here's our position. All right, let's call a press conference. Let us get these reporters / scribes to write down our policy and tell the people about it. And the feedback loop would be a town hall, a letter, customer service line. All that's way too fragmented. You know, we're much more open now. So how do you get attention for the thing you're trying to launch? How do you communicate with people who used to be so distant and are now all up in your stuff? And you
way
can hear
up.
Everything they're saying because they're on Twitter dogging you or loving you or both at the same time. So we work with marketers for causes and other things to use humor and digital to connect, you know, more deeply, to stand out above some of the noise where there's just so much crap out there.
Yeah.
You know, who do you trust and how do you know what to pay attention to? So I think comedy has a role in that as well.
Well, this is good because that goes into my next question about social media. You kind of talked about that interesting period after George W. Bush and the early Obama years. And I remember a few years ago, I was so overwhelmed by all of the crazy in the news and on social media outlets that I took a baby break.
Yeah.
And when I returned, pretty much everyone I knew had posted a video of your response to Donald Trump essentially asking President Barack Obama for his quote-unquote papers.
Right.
I had largely checked out of that entire conversation, by the way.
Good for you.
You know, I just was like, I can't, because, you know, you're friends with me on Facebook, and I have my moments where I'm just like, okay, I'm about to break it down chapter and verse, and I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm going to go eat potato pie, but I got to say this thing, get off my chest, and then I'm done. And it was funny because I was so used to you utilizing, you know, your beautiful gift of using humor to demystify things. But this time you kind of took it to the head and you were like, okay, for real, I'm deeply frustrated and this is problematic. And it was interesting because I've had so many conversations with people about social media being the devil.
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, it seems like it's become this place for mean girls and bullies to terrorize the world without restraint. And then folks drop out, you know, and you are the king of social media and you took a hiatus that you chronicled in your article in Fast Company magazine. And yet we know that social media is also this great place to connect with people, to be inspired, and to expand our possibilities. As someone who uses social media so artfully, what would be your 10 commandments for using social media effectively, benevolently, and for enjoyment?
I don't know if I have 10, but
right.
The first is click before you retweet.
Amen.
And that's just a general principle that should extend beyond Twitter. We have the ability to live in micro bubbles in a way that we weren't able to before. We can surround ourselves with people who look like us, think like us, sound like us, mm-hmm. and that's it. I never have to hear any Tea Party-esque opinion if I really don't want to. I can just wrap myself up in liberal love and marriage equality and quinoa and just roll around in turkey bacon. And it'll be a perfect world. It's called Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, like, but it goes deeper, you know, because online I can only watch the shows produced by people with my worldview. I can only listen to the artists who reflect that same set of values. And there's a danger in that. And when you start to see messages come across your transom that sound right because they kind of pre-agree with you, they're pre-approved by your biases, it's so easy to be like, yeah, what that person said. But, you know, it could be some hacker stuff. It could be malware. It could be just badly sourced, badly written pseudo-journalism.
Yeah.
And you're trafficking in rumors and maybe just outright lies, depending on the source. So there's a great temptation to be affirmed. And this world is really great at offering us head nods. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And it's so easy to press publish. That's a risky combination. So click before you retweet. The other is, you know, would you say it to their face?
Hello.
We're just going back to very basic social training for little people.
Yeah.
Would you say it to their face? Would you go up to that person in the playground and be like, you're a skank, you're disgusting, I wish you were dead. Like,
yes.
Almost certainly no, because
absolutely.
Two reasons. Three, probably one, it wouldn't feel good. It rarely feels good to go up to somebody to their face and say heinous things. You got to be a special kind of angry or wrong or have been wronged, you know, and thus angry to do that. The other is social pressure. It's unacceptable,
yeah.
You know, in that context to just roll up to somebody and start say, spewing hate. And third is fear. You know, fear of consequences. Like, that person may one-up you. They may respond
yeah.
with more than words, or their words
yeah.
might cut more deeply than your own. So
you're yeah.
exposed in some way. And the downside of a lot of social media is that we are hidden or feel like we are. Certainly, we feel like it more than we are. I mean, you just search for the N-word on Twitter, and you're reminded.
Yeah.
Like, people know everything's a hot mic now. Like,
yeah.
we can see you right there, and we can...
Right.
It's like being on TV versus doing a live show. It's like, hey, audience member on your cell phone, I'm here. I'm a person. I have feelings and an emotional place, and you're kind of walking all over that right now. So would you say it to their face is a good one? And then there's some level of what is this adding to my life? There's a level of addiction and compulsion that is easy to come by in social media because it's endless. And the internet in general, but you can just keep going and keep digging and keep... The internet doesn't end. It's not a book. There's no last chapter. There's no last page. People are constantly writing more chapters. So you can get lost. And I know countless times it's bedtime and I'm like clinging to my phone in the bed. Just one more article. Just one more... One more Gawker blog post. Ah,
right.
Yes.
Right.
And there's always one more. It's the Pringles of content. You can't have just one, but you have to fight it. You have to
yeah.
fight it and step yeah. back sometimes. Yeah.
You inform and enlighten audiences around the globe. You are a wonderful connector. In what ways are everyday people missing the opportunity to connect powerfully with others?
We risk creating these two tiers of our future society in terms of access, wealth creation, knowledge, performance, where people who are really connected and kind of know how to use some of these digital tools,
mm-hmm.
answers just come faster. You know, you'll pay less for your gas. You'll get on the flight first. You'll have lower taxes. You'll get access to housing sooner because you're in an environment where speed is such a feature and you know how to wield it. Where there's a level of literacy required, it's literacy. It's
yeah.
that. It's if you can't read, you don't know what exit is on the highway. You're just going based on memory or what the person before you did. And so when you're put into a new environment, you can't decode it. It kind of looks like gibberish. And so I think for the thing that people might be missing out on, it's very easy and somewhat satisfying to dismiss a lot of the tech stuff and the social media stuff and digital this and app that as just entertainment, as just a time suck, as just people talking about what they had for lunch. It is not that. It is so much more than that. Those are entry-level footholds into this new land, and what we really are building is a new language.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't speak it, if you can't understand it and hear it, you're just literally living on a different plane within existence. And so I think what folks are missing out on most is, you know, people say, why should I be on Twitter? You don't have to be on Twitter. First of all, I got no stake in that. But think about what you are listening to much more than what you're saying. There is so much, even in the Twitter as example context, that you can just know. You can learn and be aware of things in a way that was not possible before. And don't worry about what to say yet. You know, people have stage fright in social media. It's not about saying things all the time. A lot of people like me use it that way, and that skews the perception because you're like, I can't say things like that, or well, he's a trained comedian, so it's not even a fair compare. Not about that. Even if I were mute, I could still gather a lot from my eyes and my ears. And so the ability to have a bit of a competitive advantage when it comes to knowledge and information, that is the opportunity. You might find a job. You might find a friend. You might find a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're more open and connected to this kind of new linguistic arena, this new
but
way.
But Baratunde, what would you say, because I know when I'm speaking in audiences across the country, especially with elders who are connecting with young people who are trying to do social justice work, and the young people are very frustrated about how to use social media to connect. And then the elders are like, oh, you guys are always on your phone. I mean, I remember having this conversation recently where I said, if they're always on their phones, that's where you need to be.
Yeah.
You know, and so what would you say to them about how to make use of it or how to even begin to connect with it? Because I think for so many people, they are just so off-putting, and it's overwhelming. So, for example, my mom bought a Kindle last year. I mean, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
And she loves the Kindle more than she loves me.
Well, that's just because the Kindle is newer.
Right, I guess. I don't know. I'm a little busy, whatever. But honestly, she took to it so quickly, and, you know, she'll be 60 next year. I'm trying to figure out a way that, you know, someone like you would speak to that audience, like speak to my mama and them who are like, with the Facebook and the Twitter chat, I don't know what that's all about, and that's all you guys do. Like, what are they missing, and how could you say to them, and there's a place for you here as well?
Oprah.
Yeah.
Okay. My mother was a huge Oprah fan, as I mentioned, and when she would watch the show, she refused having a full computer for just weird reasons. My sister and I never understood it. She was always like piecing things together. She's like, oh, I'm fine with my Trio. And she was kind of doing the smartphone thing. She had a little modem sled that she would connect to, like a little tablet thing. And I think she maybe just didn't want to get fully sucked into the whole internet. She liked walking outside and crocheting and cooking and just kind of being in this physical world. But Oprah changed all that. And she would call me up and be like, okay, so I just watched Oprah, and I need you to go to Oprah.com and tell me what's happening. I'm like, what do you mean tell you what's – just what's there? I'm like, you want me to just describe a whole website to you? Like, this is why we're trying to get you a computer. Interest is the thing. You know, if you don't tell a kid, oh, books are great. You should be into books, literacy and words – in chapter and verse and prose and all that. Oh, it's trust me, young person, this is your future. You say, no, you like Batman, right? You like, Agatha Christie, whatever it is. It's some kid who likes Agatha Christie. That's a weird child, by the way. But, you know, these folks all have interests. They all have friends. They all have shows and celebrities that they're into and activities, whether it's knitting or farming. Mm-hmm. There is a place for you in some online realm that gets you more of that. You learn how to do some gardening thing because you're watching this YouTube series on how to grow whatever. And there's no way you could have done that. I guess you could wait for PBS to re-air that one special about, you know, better home and garden, this or that. Or you can just go to YouTube and be like, yeah, I think I want to try growing orchids this year. What do you got, Internet? So coming through an interest, not through the vague Internet platform. It is overwhelming. The Internet's overwhelming. Facebook's overwhelming. Twitter's overwhelming. There's too much of everything.
Yeah.
But all these people, I think, you know, can find their interest and maybe find their people, too. It's like, oh, you remember so-and-so from when you grew up? You know, they're probably on Facebook now. And they have a bit of a reunion because geography is not nearly what it used to be in separation.
No, not at all. Okay, who is the most remarkable funny person you've encountered in your life?
Whoa. Most remarkable funny person in my life.
Ever.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
I'm not trying to get you in trouble, by the way.
No, that's fine. You know, I got two answers. One, because I don't know if encounter is technically accurate here, but I've been thinking about Bill Cosby recently, and I saw him live in Lowell, Massachusetts over a decade ago, and he just blew me away. And this was, he's got a kind of an angry Cosby thing that's been running, and now I haven't seen him in a while, so maybe he's like laying low, but he's the master and really, 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 really great at what he does. And it's sort of like almost depressing because you're like, oh, I will never, ever come close to being that. Is that the pinnacle of this art form? Shoot. There's no hope for any of us if he says the bar is so high. So he's really, really great. And then, God, you said my life. That'll come back to haunt me. But in my life so far, as I can recall in the moment, some parentheses around that, some asterisks or something. The show that makes me laugh out loud the most right now is weird. It's the Eric Andre Show. It's on Adult Swim. I knew Eric from doing comedy in Boston over a decade ago. I think he went to Emerson or BU, can't remember which one, but he was part of that scene. Mm-hmm. And his show it's so funny. I'm on a plane and I'm disturbing other people watching it. And I love a lot of shows. I'm not one of those comedians that can't enjoy other comedians. Love Issa Rae, Awkward Black Girl, super funny, super awkward. Love Key and Peele. I'm so happy they're on Comedy Central. But Eric's show, it's just, when I think laughing out loud, it's ridiculous. And there's a black dude doing super absurdist comedy, occasionally about race, but not really. That's not his thing. It's just, he's funny. He's really, really funny. Yeah. Yeah.
If you were not Baratunde 5.0, and I'm putting 5.0 there because God knows you have so much that you've accomplished at this date, and I know that there's so much more to come, who would you be?
I might be a dancer.
What kind of dancer?
All kinds.
Okay.
Some kind of maybe modern mixed with hip-hop, like not ballet, nothing stilted, right? Something loose, something open. Mm-hmm. I love to dance, and when I think about all the expression that I've experimented with, the words on paper, the words out of my mouth, pseudo-acting stuff, certainly like hosting stuff,
mm-hmm.
that's all great, but dancing is when I'm like actually the most and can just leave everything out there. And I've never thought of making it a profession, but it is the most fun that I think I have in this world.
What is the greatest gift anyone has ever given you?
Oh, the gift of love, April, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Or the Xbox, the first Xbox. That was pretty dope. Love versus Xbox.
Love, Xbox, love. It's all the same stuff.
The gift is not a physical gift. I think so. Every answer could always, in any kind of interview, especially one with you, come back to my mother. But I think legitimately she crafted a life for me and with me in a way that few parents do. She had standards. And there are many things that she wouldn't tolerate. She never forced me to do anything. She didn't say, you have to do this, you have to do that. She didn't try to live her life through me and thus have me resenting choices that I didn't really make. There were no ultimatums. She exposed me to a lot of the world and trusted that I would figure it out. So I think if there's a word that describes the gift she gave, it's trust. And a parent, you know, sort of trusting their kid from a pretty early age, trusting me to understand the family finances and what a wreck they were, trusting me to not, you know, engage in the obvious behavior, which was so easily accessed right outside our front door for many years, trusting that I'd figure out some major challenge I'm having at school and not always come running to her. Like, it's this delicate balance where you want from a parent to kind of be told what to do at some level, like, feed me, guide me, nurture me, clothe me, house me. But you also, like, don't want anything to do with them. Your time is done. This is my world. Get out of here. You're embarrassing me. And from the parent to the other end, I'm not a parent. I've kind of reflected on her parenthood and a lot of the little pseudo-nieces and nephews I have around the world. There's some things you can control. There's most things you can't. And she, I think, got that and didn't force it. And there's a lot of conflict and a lot of ripple effect of parents being a little too aggressive and trying to finish their lives through their kids, or just being so confused and frustrated. There is no manual. But she trusted, and it's paid back so much. I mean, a lot of my own confidence and experimentation and, to some degree, fearlessness, and there are definitely things I fear, so I say to some degree,
yeah,
is just because that's how she kind of, those are the parameters she set up. And then maybe mm-hmm. some genetics. So she also directly contributed to them by just having me. Yeah.
That's beautiful. Baratunde Thurston for turning the salty into the spicy and sweet with humor and teaching people how to really be black. I thank you.
thank you so much, April.
I'm by the AID list, and I will see you soon, my friend. Thank you.
All right. Have a beautiful day.
To learn more about Baratunde Thurston, visit him online at baratunde.com.
You've been listening to the AYG List with April Yvonne Garrett, a part of the Tavis Smiley Network on Blog Talk Radio. The AYG List posts every Tuesday and Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. April would love to hear from you on Facebook and Twitter and invite you to take a peek into her world on Instagram at the AYG List. Also, visit her inspiration, lifestyle, and social commentary blog, theayglist.com. Thank you for listening.
Don't sweat the technique.